Welcome to American Indian and Alaskan Native Living, a program designed to educate and inspire listeners throughout Indian country. American Indian and Alaskan Native Living is hosted by Dr. David DeRose, a board-certified specialist in both internal medicine and preventive medicine. Dr. DeRose has a wide range of experience with Native health issues, and he is here today to help you learn more about your health. Here is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome to American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. We've got a really exciting show lined up for you today. It's an amazing insight in an area of indigenous health that we don't often think about, and it's going to take us on a journey halfway around the world, but it will also relate to North American indigenous peoples. That is what I've walked away from my preliminary discussions with Dr. Barry Bacon thinking. Dr. Bacon is with us in our virtual studio. Barry, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Good to be here, David.
Barry, you and I have had the privilege of knowing each other for many years. Our paths crossed in medical school. We kind of have taken some different directions, but also similar. We both went into primary care and then have had life experiences that have had us working with First Nation peoples in various parts of the world. But we want to bring people up to speed. If they don't know you, tell us a little bit about, well, first of all, whatever motivated you to become a physician in the first place.
It really goes back a long ways, David. When I was about 6 years old, it was my father who told me, "Son, I see a lot of empathy in you." I had no idea what he was talking about. But that idea of having empathy and becoming a physician, which was the message he gave me, stayed with me. And so all the way through my education, I hung on to that idea that I could become a physician. I looked at other paths and I considered other ways. But when I thought about the opportunity to really influence people and to bring healing to them and to become a healer, I decided, yes, this is what I really want to do. And I listened to that initial instruction by my father and decided this is the path that I want to follow, and had a chance to go to excellent schools, to get a good education, felt that those blessings, the gifts of hard work and the gift of education that my parents gave me, were some things that I wanted to continue to pursue and to not allow for those things to lag. So going into medical school was an exciting time because none of the rest of my family had completed a higher education.
Wow. I love your story, Barry. And it's so, I think, inspiring for many people throughout Indian country and beyond. You know, just the power of vision of a parent, and especially a parent isn't saying, well, follow in my footsteps because I'm a physician. This is really uncharted territory as far as your family, I hear you saying. And I may be thinking of someone who's one of our Native listeners. Maybe they don't feel that they have anyone in their immediate family that they can relate to, but they have some of these career aspirations, or maybe others have said things like was said to you, where people see, whether it's empathic skills or whether it's intellectual skills, and they say you could give back to your people, but you need more training. So I think a lot of people resonate with that. I mean, that had to be challenging, though, to kind of break those family roles or the role models that were around you. Am I relating to that, or was that not much of an issue for you?
You know, because I had the support of my parents, the rest of the background of my family wasn't so much of an influence. Although I have to say that I have a number of great uncles, for example, who did pursue education paths and decided to give back in this way. One of the privileges I've had is to teach physicians here in Northeast Washington, where I live. Early on in my career here, I had the opportunity to teach and train a Native physician, family physician, whose dream is to give back to his people. Mm. So he gave me insight into how difficult that can be and what a challenge that can be. But the answer that I heard him say was, you know, our fathers told us, this is what we should do, get an education, give back in some way. And he followed the advice of his fathers. And that made a huge difference for him. He continues to practice in Washington State today among Native peoples.
One of the interesting things about your journey that I've kind of wondered, and I'm sure my listeners would have this question as well, you have this vision to go into medicine. You go into it because you want to give back, because you want to serve. And all of us in 4 years of medical school were asking that question. I mean, if we have that kind of aspiration, well, where do we go? What kind of specialty do we choose? Where do we go for residency? Tell us a little bit about how that process played out for you, Dr. Bacon.
You're right, David, in the fact that I had many options as I went into medical school. So one of the things that really helped me was to be as open as possible to all of the different specialties. And as I went through my rotations, I tried to see how I fit with each of those rotations: internal medicine, obstetrics, pediatrics, surgery. And the truth is, I loved all of them. So I said, okay, I've got to do something that incorporates a broad brushstrokes of medicine. So is that emergency medicine? Is that family medicine? The other thing that I noticed is that I really enjoyed the relationships that I developed with patients. And I always wanted to know what happened to them after they were released. Mm. Well, that's not emergency medicine. You see them, you're off shift, they go on to someone else. You always send them on to their primary care physician. And then finally, when it came to OB, I realized that I like taking care of moms, but I also like taking care of children. Well, OB doesn't do that, and pediatrics doesn't do both. So you're really talking about family medicine. And those various decision points are what guided me into family medicine and primary care.
Now, I know a little bit about your journey because you and I have spoken, and of course, we have a long history together. Not that it's an intimate history of us calling every year. Our paths cross paths relatively seldom. But at the same time, I know you ended up in a program that wasn't a really high-profile program, the way some people measure programs. And just kind of an interesting aside, I ran into another physician colleague not all that long ago, and he was telling me he's an anesthesiologist, and he was saying often the best surgeons came from the what would be lower-tier programs. He said it seemed like the people that went to these high-powered programs, they may have become good researchers, but they didn't get as much hands-on experience. And people that sometimes went to smaller programs often got better hands-on training. Now, I know you went into family practice, as you've mentioned, and you went to a program, if I'm not mistaken, that only had family practice training in the whole institution. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. Hinsdale Hospital in Illinois, one of the suburbs of Chicago, has only family medicine as its focus for training physicians. I don't know whether that's changed, but at least at the time, in the 1980s, that was the case.
And so you're going through family practice training, whereas if you're at a big university hospital, when you went through OB, there'd be OB residents who would be getting the first crack at things, and maybe even OB fellows, you know, getting further training and their first opportunity to do special things. But when you're doing OB as a family practice resident at Hinsdale Hospital, you're the only residents there. So I would guess you got quite a bit of hands-on training.
It's true. And it does make a difference, I feel. Being in an unopposed program, meaning that it's only family medicine, which means that you're typically going to be in a smaller hospital, maybe not a university setting, not an ivory tower kind of setting. You'll be in a smaller community-based hospital. And I think that that is the best kind of training for family medicine, especially if you're going to be working in a rural setting because of the breadth of practice that you're expected to cover.
So you get this great training in the Chicago area. And I know one of the other narratives that we often hear in medicine is, you know, where you trained is where you stay. And a lot of folks, you know, whether you went to medical school in a certain venue or whether you go to residency, those are two pretty big draws for people to stay as far as their practice. You have connections there, people you know. People know you, respect you as you went through their programs. But it doesn't sound like you ended up at all in Southern California where you did your medical school at Loma Linda University or in Hinsdale or the Chicago area. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's true. My dream was always to give back to people who could never pay me back, at least for part of my career. So my dream was to go overseas and to serve people who had desperate needs in terms of access to care. And that's what I continued to, that was the dream I continued to pursue all the way through residency.
Now, my wife and I have had a discussion over the years. We've done some similar things in different venues. We've often said, and I've told her, I said, if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't have done a lot of these things because the kind of discussion we're having right now, Barry, is talking about much less remunerative work when you're working with people who are underserved or have certain challenges. So I noticed that it seems like Shelley, your wife, has been a pretty solid partner along the journey. Is that a correct perspective that I've got there?
You know, I think that at this point in our marriage, it's incredibly wonderful to have a partner like Shelley. She is such an advocate for the things that we work on, and she has jumped in with both feet. Interestingly, that wasn't always the case. So it's a bit of a change in terms of our oneness in working on a common goal. She has her own project that she works on, where we have identified health disparities in our backyard, in our community, that we want to try to address. And she is very much an integral part of that. And I have my part, and we work together often on those projects where we really identify health needs in our community that need to be addressed.
So you are currently based in the Northwest. You have a deep interest, especially in the underserved there, but you have a much broader global perspective. You shared with us earlier about wanting to go someplace where people couldn't pay you back, but did you early on think that you were going to land overseas and actually stay overseas for a period of time?
I hope that that was the case, but there was a time when we pursued this idea of working overseas in an underserved area where there really wasn't an opportunity to do so. There seemed to be the doors were a bit closed at the time, and so we had to knock on a few doors in order to find one that was open to us, including all the way through residency. There just wasn't a lot of interest in placing individuals overseas in those days. So we had to do a bit of convincing of folks that were in those positions of making the decision.
So did you end up overseas right out of residency?
That's correct. Right in 1987, after finishing family medicine residency, we had the opportunity to serve in Malawi, Africa, which was a wonderful experience. We served there for 3 years.
Now, most folks that I talk with, they know the continent of Africa. They kind of have a picture of maybe the continent in their mind. But once you start talking about individual countries, they might know where Egypt is or something in South Africa, but then their eyes kind of fog over. So give us some perspective geographically. Where is Malawi?
Malawi, it turns out, is kind of hard to find on the continent of Africa because Africa is so big. It's a huge continent. But if you start at South Africa down in the southern tip of the African continent, and then you follow the eastern shoreline along the Indian Ocean, the next country to the north is Mozambique. And on the west side of Mozambique is the country of Malawi. It's a small inland landlocked country that is very poor. It's one of the very poorest countries in the world. And that's where we served, is in the country of Malawi.
So you served there for a number of years, is that safe to say?
Yes, for 3 years, until 1990.
Okay. And any special lessons learned that might be valuable to health professionals who are tuning into this show?
Yes. Don't be arrogant. Listen to people. Be willing to learn. Because there was so much that I'd learned in residency that I had to continue to learn after the fact. I needed to learn to listen to my patients. HIV was just taking off at the time. It was a brand new disease that we had no experience with. And in Africa in particular, the disease became the number one cause of death in our small hospital, just over a three-year period. The incidence was 8% when we first came to Malawi among pregnant women. And then over the three-year period, that 8% prevalence increased to 24%. So it tripled just in 3 years. So we saw where this disease was going at the time, and we really felt the need to try to provide scientifically valid, appropriate information to people in that setting, because the only opportunity we had was prevention.
This is extremely interesting, and a lot of people think, yeah, it's interesting, but how does this relate to me? We're going to bring it home because you're talking about some very exciting initiatives making a difference in indigenous populations as far as health education, medical education. We're going to get into that in our next segment. I'm Dr. David DeRose, my guest, Dr. Barry Bacon, speaking about things that are of relevance to First Nation peoples worldwide, but also to you, even if you don't identify as someone with indigenous roots wherever you're living. I'm Dr. DeRose. We'll be back with more right after this.
Today's broadcast has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please reach out to us on the web at aianl.org. That stands for American Indian Alaska Native Living. Again, aianl.org. Or you can call us at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope. Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
When Jim died, I wondered if I would be able to keep the farm. Then I heard about the USDA's loan program for socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers. It's for women and minorities who may be having trouble getting credit. Once I was approved, the USDA's Farm Service Agency helped me get the credit I needed. Now I don't have to sell, and I can pass the farm down to my kids the way Jim's dad passed it down to him. I know he'd like that.
Contact your local USDA service center or visit www.fsa.usda.gov.
Social Security is with you through life's journey from birth to retirement. As your life changes year to year, so do your needs. For over 80 years, Social Security has helped to meet your needs and is committed to improving access to the services that make a difference in your life. Today, you can verify your earnings, estimate your future benefits, apply for retirement, manage your benefits, and even change your address, all from the comfort of your home. Social Security's online services help put you in control with secure access to your information anytime, anywhere, allowing you to spend more time with family, friends, or simply just enjoying the day. Social Security, securing today and tomorrow. See what you can do online at socialsecurity.gov.
Produced at U.S. taxpayer expense.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian and Alaska Native Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back to American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. My guest, Dr. Barry Bacon, he's trained as a family practice physician, but he's doing things that are making a big difference when it comes to Indigenous health and health disparities. Dr. Bacon has been sharing his journey with us, if you're just catching us, about how he had a vision from an early age instilled by his parents to go into medicine. And completed medical school and then a family practice residency in the Chicago area. And then he was serving in Malawi, Africa. Barry, you're here, as you mentioned, in the end of the last segment. You come to a country where you weren't necessarily expecting to be dealing with a lot of infectious diseases, at least not HIV. That really wasn't on our radar screen when we first started medical school back in 1980. But it becomes, a quarter of the population that you're seeing there in Malawi. You mentioned you had spent some 3 years there, is that correct?
Yes, from 1987 to 1990, that's correct.
Now, as a family practice trained physician, I mean, a lot of folks today with a family practice training, they may end up in the emergency room, they may end up in a primary care practice, but from my observation here in the U.S., I don't see a lot of family practitioners in most of the areas where I've resided doing any obstetrics or doing any surgery. It's mostly outpatient, clinic-based medicine. Is that kind of how your practice evolved in Malawi, or did it evolve very differently than that?
In Malawi, the needs for generally trained physicians, like family doctors, are very broad. Just out of necessity in that setting, in Blantyre, Malawi, a fairly good-sized city, we were doing inpatient care, admitting people to the hospital. We were doing obstetrics. We were doing surgical obstetrics, C-sections, doing some surgery, doing some outpatient care, pediatrics, emergency care. So we were often on call for just the whole spectrum of care. And because there were only three of us in that small hospital in Blantyre, even the obstetrician had to take call. Sometimes we'd call each other as colleagues, even when we weren't on call, to say, please, can you come and help me with this particular situation? We've got a difficult circumstance that we're working on. But in general, we all had to be generalists. You know, we had to take care of the breadth of what we're seeing coming through the door.
Now, you mentioned to me, and we alluded to it on air, that this whole experience really had a role in shaping your perspective on medicine. And to me, I think it's fascinating as we speak about how our life journeys shape what is going to come in the future. And so I know you're an individual who, I think, is it fair, make sure I'm not putting words in your mouth, is it fair to say that you would say you were seeking God or the Creator as far as direction throughout your life?
Yes, that was a very important principle and what motivated me highly. The ethic or the motivation to go and serve people in another country, in another culture who could not pay me back, was instilled very early by going to spiritual religious services. And I heard the stories of people suffering in other parts of the world. And even at a very early age, I responded compassionately toward their suffering and thought, I want to give back in some way. I want to be part of providing some form of relief to children, to individuals suffering in other parts of the world. Malawi opened that window. Malawi opened that door for me to be able to experience that, and that has shaped the entire direction of my practice and what I do now.
So I know a lot of times when people do something that's very sacrificial, there's no doubt you could probably tell us about many challenges. There are probably many stresses on your family being there, you personally, I mean, physically wise, I mean, sleep or nutrition or infectious diseases yourself. And it seems like a lot of people might go into a situation like that and say, hey, well, I did that and now forget about it and move on with my life. But I've gathered, Barry, that is not what happened to you.
There were times when, after I came back from Malawi, when I would sit on our property and I would imagine hearing the voices of African women singing, coming over the hills, still calling to me. Because they're, as far as I'm concerned, those people who are suffering in other parts of the world are my patients as well. And I can't let that go. I have to be involved. I have to find a way to carve out time to set a place at my table for people who are suffering. And that is a very powerful ethic that has continued to shape my practice.
So how did that impact your practice there in Northwestern Washington?
I think that my work internationally helped to make me a better physician at home. It helped me to see health disparities in my own backyard that I wasn't aware of until I stepped outside of the clinic model and into the community. And I tried to see what barriers there were for people to access care, what barriers there were for people to access good nutrition, exercise, other things that we need, mental health support, that sort of thing. And so by taking a step outside the clinic and looking at health disparities in my own backyard that were based on those experiences internationally, I think it made me a better physician here. The other piece to that is that I wanted to stay connected to global health in some form. And I was able to carve out time almost on an annual basis to go for a couple of weeks and to try to bring some healing and some support to people in other parts of the world. And that has continued to be an important component of my practice here.
Tell us a little bit more about this, because I know you and I have talked about where we want to go with this show. And just for those of you that are tuning in as listeners, Dr. Bacon is involved with a very exciting project that we're going to talk about just in a few minutes. And there's going to be opportunities for you to be involved if you're a health professional or if in some way you want to support the program financially with your prayers, with sharing the word with other people. Before we get to that point in the dialogue, Dr. Bacon, you are making this case for basically the power of dealing with underserved communities, whether they're indigenous or not, but worldwide. You, is it safe to say, have ended up spending more of those couple weeks annually in Africa, or have you been throughout much of the world in global health capacities?
I've looked at other parts of the world. I've had a chance to make a couple of trips to Guatemala and another to Peru. and one to the South Pacific to try to bring and provide medical care and health education to those parts of the world, typically with a group of maybe young people or others who want to be involved, want to see what global health is all about, but have, maybe don't feel like they're invited. So we've tried to create opportunities for people of a variety of different backgrounds to come and join us for those trips. Most of them have been to Africa, though, in answer to your question, David. Africa is a different continent. Africa has lagged behind in many ways. So the greatest health disparities in terms of access to care, in terms of poverty, in terms of income, in terms of other measures, in terms of conflict, for that matter, reside in Africa. So it's almost like dropping off the edge of a cliff when it comes to many of the countries in Africa where people suffer still in very difficult circumstances. One of the projects that I didn't tell you about, and maybe I can just highlight that for a moment, is we had a chance in 1996 to visit a place in northern Kenya where we built a school and a church there. And that intervention, you wouldn't think that 2 weeks of your life would make that much of a difference, but the people were so impacted by that that they continued to contact us over the years. And in 2011, they said, would you come and help us to work out the conflict between the tribes? So we had a chance to develop peacemaking as a health intervention, because we all know that if without peace as a foundation for society, it dramatically affects our health. So much falls out as a result of that. So we started a project called the Pokot Turkana Peace Initiative, where we said we will work with you for 5 years. Well, we're 10 years out now. And we will work on whatever your priorities are. You create the projects and the priorities that you have, and you individually as tribes can decide what your priorities will be, and we will invest in you for a period of time. But peace must be what each of these interventions, each of these investments point toward. And the stories that are coming from that intervention that has continued to work on its own, we have native people there who are leading out in this project, and they are doing incredible, wonderful work because they understand the principles that guide this project, that we must be peacemakers in the world if we're going to make any progress.
I love this. It sounds like we could have done a whole show on this topic, couldn't we, Barry?
It's another part of my life that I live this incredibly wonderful life because I've followed this path. I would never trade my life for any other life that I can imagine. So being a part of this project in northern Kenya, even if that was the only piece to my life, is so rewarding. Some of the orphans that we help to support, they've said, would you choose me? Would you give me the opportunity to become a nurse? One of them is now in nursing school, finishing nursing school, because she wants to give back to her community. Another has entered into teacher's school. She's going to be giving back. She wants to go back to her people. A third has said, would you, on the other side of the conflict, has said, would you choose me to be a pastor? We don't have any pastor here. I'd like to go to seminary, and then I'd like to give back and become the pastor for my people. And we said, my goodness, I would love to do that. There are 50 children in a school right now who would not otherwise be in a school because of our work there. It just keeps going. And it blesses our lives in so many ways, David. It's just amazing.
Well, this is exciting. And where we're going in our next segment, for those of you that are listening, is there's opportunities for you to be involved in projects like this. Dr. Bacon is going to be sharing about an amazing project that I think, and I won't pretend to know everything that's happening in Indian country, but I think there's some applications to indigenous peoples here. We're going to speak about a different indigenous population in Africa. An amazing story. You want to stay by. I'm Dr. David DeRose, my guest, Dr. Barry Bacon. We've got a lot more coming up in the second half of the show. That's going to be here before you know it, right after these messages.
American Indian and Alaska Native Living will continue in a moment. If you have questions or comments about today's pre-recorded broadcast, please contact us on the web at aianl.org or call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673.
A message from the National Police Association. It used to be that any able-bodied person would offer to assist a police officer in danger. Now, passersby are more likely to take a video. There's a better use for your phone when an officer's in trouble. Call 911. Tell the operator where you are and what you see. Then, start your video to provide evidence later. To learn more about how you can assist law enforcement, visit nationalpolice.org. That's nationalpolice.org.
Unlike other health concerns, mental illness is not always easy to see. Depression won't show up on an eye chart, and you can't measure it on your bathroom scale. Sorting out a mental health concern is not something to attempt on your own. You won't find a bipolar disorder by looking at a thermometer. Like many other health conditions, help for mental illness takes professional diagnosis and treatment. Anxiety won't just go away under a stick-on bandage. So the sooner you seek treatment, the better. If you or a loved one has a mental health concern, don't go it alone. Find out what to do. For 24-hour free and confidential information and treatment referral, call 1-800-662-HELP. Learn more at samhsa.gov/support. That's samhsa.gov/support.
Using meth taught me everything about freedom, only not like you think. It taught me how easy it is to lose your freedom. If you think meth is taking control of you, ask for help. You have the power to be truly free. I know. I'm Jan, and I'm free from meth.
If you or someone you know is struggling with meth, call 1-800-662-HELP for 24-hour free and confidential treatment referral. Learn more at samhsa.gov/meth.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian and Alaskan Native Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back to the second half of today's edition of American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. My guest, Dr. Barry Bacon. Dr. Bacon is an MD. He's a specialist in family practice with a broad range of experience worldwide, globally, making a difference in people's lives, whether it's in his backyard, in the place he calls home. Well, maybe he calls it home, the Pacific Northwest. It seems like he really sees the world as his home, and maybe home away from home, if I were to read between the lines. But Dr. Bacon, we've been speaking about an amazing life journey, and like you said, you wouldn't have scripted it any other way. Other folks may not look back at their life and feel that way, but we want to talk about an experience that can change anyone's life, especially healthcare providers, because over some recent years, you have gotten involved with trying to set up a medical school for Indigenous peoples, especially in Africa. Tell us a little bit about that story.
On one of my trips to Kenya, I met a young physician's assistant by the name of Getbel Chamjok. Getbel is from the area of South Sudan, and he escaped the violence there in the 1980s, made his way across Ethiopia, then down to Kenya, came to the U.S., became a physician's assistant here. He's connected to the diaspora, the people that are living outside of Ethiopia, outside of South Sudan, and he connects with many of them online. But his dream is to give back, and he is not alone. There are a team of people from that part of the world who have said, we see our people suffering back at home. We want to make a difference there. We want to change health outcomes. We think the best opportunity is to develop education, high-quality education, medical education in that part of the world. So this is their dream. But they introduced this dream to me, and they said, would you be willing to join us? I said, absolutely, I'm on board. I'm looking for a place where I can invest more regularly in medical education for physicians and for other health professionals in that part of the world.
Now, you and I have spoken off air about how a lot of your overseas trips really led to opportunities for you to train people, not just to deliver care, but to invest, if you will, in the infrastructure, the human infrastructure in the places you visited. Tell us a little bit about those connections.
There was a trip in 2011 where I took a team of people to a very remote part of Western Zambia, a place called Yuka Hospital. The team's feedback to me, we had some incredible experiences, you know, just seeing how people suffer in that part of the world. But part of the feedback I received from the team was, is this really making a difference? Is a two-week trip making a difference that has a lasting impact on the people here? And it got me to thinking, maybe my best investment would be in educating, providing high-quality education to people in Africa, health professionals. Maybe that's the best investment, and making a longer-term commitment to one site. So I started looking for such a site, and I taught in several places in East Africa for relatively short periods of time. I would plug in where I would find a group of physicians, a group of Americans working, and come alongside them and offer to give them relief and teach with them. And then when this project in Western Ethiopia came to my attention, I said, okay, this is the place. This is where I want to invest more regularly, maybe on an annual basis, in providing medical education to physicians in particular.
So Barry, one of the things that radio is notoriously difficult for is giving people a sense of geography. We can't project a map of Africa. We talked about this earlier in the show, but you've been mentioning South Sudan. I think a lot of people have heard about the conflict in that part of the world. You've mentioned Ethiopia. Geographically, are these contiguous countries? Where in Africa are they? Help us a little bit with that.
Well, in the northeast corner of Africa is Egypt. I think most people know where that is, right on the Mediterranean Sea. If you go straight south from Egypt, the next country to the south is Sudan. So the southern part of that country is what's become South Sudan. It's one of the newest countries in the world. South Sudan's eastern border is right up against the western border of Ethiopia. Ethiopia is now a landlocked country. It wasn't always the case. It had ports on the Red Sea, for example, until Eritrea split out from the north part of Ethiopia. So if you can imagine being surrounded by Sudan, Eritrea, Somalia, on that little horn that pokes out into the Arabian Sea from the easternmost part of Africa, that's Somalia, and that forms the eastern border of Ethiopia. And then Kenya is to the south. So if you think about, if you know where any of those countries are, that's where we're talking about. The region of Ethiopia is the far western section of Ethiopia, a little thumb-like projection that sticks out into South Sudan, and that's the region of Gambela. That's our target area.
So we're talking about a country, if you will, that has basically a variety of indigenous tribal peoples. And of course, when we talk about tribes and communities, and we go back historically, there were no country division lines like we have today. So the people living in Western Ethiopia may have their cousins or aunts or uncles living in South Sudan. Is that safe to say?
Yes, very safe to say. The peoples in people that occupy the westernmost part of Ethiopia in the Gambela region are the same people groups, the same tribes, the same languages and cultures that also occupy the easternmost part of South Sudan.
So what is the opportunity now? I understand you're actually working with people there locally to set up a medical school. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, because of this dream that our friends had from that part of the world and an opportunity to come alongside them and provide our support, we began working on this project together, and we started to by engaging the local people in Western Ethiopia. We spoke to the leadership there and told them of our dream and asked them, is there an opportunity here? And it was clear that there was a lot of enthusiasm about creating such a school. The country of Ethiopia as a whole has gone through some difficult times in terms of the quality of medical education. A few years ago, they recognized that there were more Ethiopian physicians practicing in the United States than were practicing in Ethiopia. And they said, we've got to stop this hemorrhage. This is a brain drain that's happening with our country. It's not unique to Ethiopia, but it's certainly happening there. So their answer was, well, why don't we just create more medical schools so that by sheer numbers of physicians, we'll have some that will stay and provide care for local people. That has worked to a greater or lesser degree. Part of the problem with doing that, if you suddenly expand the number of medical schools, doubling, tripling the number of medical schools in the country, you don't have enough trainers available. And so the quality of that educational experience really goes down. What we're trying to do is say, why don't we come alongside you? Why don't we bring trainers with us? We see the need for training physicians locally with African challenges, with African diseases, with African cultures and languages. We will come alongside you as a team from the U.S., and we will teach. We'll start by intervening at the high school level, because if we're going to train physicians in that part of the world, you go directly from high school into medical education. Mm. Well, you have to sort of rev up and improve the high school experience so that they can be prepared to enter into a professional school. That isn't happening routinely in Gambela. As a result, they are ill-prepared to enter into medical school. So we need people to teach math. We need people to teach science. We need people to teach English and writing and all of those skills in order to prepare them to be competitive on a national basis so that they can enter into medical school.
So you are actively looking for people who will spend anywhere from relatively short amounts of time in Ethiopia, or maybe even virtually, as well as people that may be willing to relocate there as you look to launch this new medical school. And when I say launch, you're not doing it. You're working with locals who are doing it, of course, but support this new medical school in this region called Gambela of Western Ethiopia. Tell us how someone might be able to get involved. I mean, how does this process work?
You're right, David. We are looking for instructors of various kinds. So there are opportunities to teach community health, for example, opportunities to teach prevention, opportunities to teach spiritual care or math or science or English or writing skills, as well as all the clinical disciplines. And because of their commitment, the commitment of Gambela University, the university that is locally a partner with us, our U.S.-based team, they're going to make it available so that people could teach virtually. They can teach from abroad. But we also recognize, because of our experience working in Africa, that there's a need for boots on the ground as well. Mm-hmm. You cannot teach empathy. You cannot teach compassionate care from a distance nearly as effectively as they're at the bedside. You have to actually model compassionate, competent care for patients. And so we need both. And there's an opportunity, like you said, for people to plug in. We are building our team right now. We are willing to accept CVs, our resumes from people who just want to say, I want to give back in some way. Here's an area of the world where the physician to the population ratio in South Sudan in 2012 was one physician per 100,000 population.
Wow.
That is an unimaginable number. That is, for all practical purposes, lack of any physician care. And the physicians who were there working in the country, our team would go and try to support them. They were burning out like crazy. They could hardly continue their work because they were so overwhelmed.
So, Barry, I don't know what the figure is in the U.S. Do you have any idea what the ratio is of physicians to population here?
It's several hundred. One number that I heard was 250 per 100,000. That was, I think, somebody in California. But that would be a more representative number of what you'd expect in the U.S. It's hundreds per 100,000.
Okay. And where it's one per 100,000 there.
Correct.
So we're like 250 times better off.
And if you can imagine, that represents a line of people 38 miles long if they're standing back to back to back. And if a physician started seeing just the people that were in their care, 100,000 people, every 15 minutes, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it would take almost 3 years to get through that line once.
Wow.
It's unimaginable. It's just like, are you serious? Is it really that bad in some parts of the world? But here's the other part of it. The physician salary provided by the government in South Sudan right now is $14 a month.
Wow. Now, someone's going to say, well, $14, you can buy all your food and housing and everything because the cost of living is so much cheaper. Is that true?
No, absolutely not. It's expensive to live in the capital city of South Sudan.
Wow.
The economy is all upside down.
So, Barry, people are going to want to talk with you. They want to reach out to you. There's health professionals, maybe people with training in basic sciences or other clinical disciplines beside medicine. How does someone learn more about the project, send you their resume, their CV? How do they do that?
The best and most direct way is to write to me at my email address, baconberry@juno.com. So baconberry@juno.com.
Okay, let me make sure I've got this right. You've got your last name first, Bacon, Bacon. Then your first name, Barry, Barry, at Juno, JUNO.com.
That's correct.
Okay. So if you're tuning in to American Indian and Alaska Native Living right now, Dr. Barry Bacon would love to dialogue with you. He'd love to hear your vision or hear your questions about how you might be able to contribute. We're going to talk more about that when we come back for our final segment, and also some powerful lessons that can impact you and your community. The place I want to go, Barry, in this final segment is talking about First Nation peoples here in North America. Are you learning some things that might make a difference here? And maybe, if it's not already being discussed in some quarters, should there be a medical school exclusively or especially for Native Americans here on the North American continent? We'll talk about that in our final segment. I'm Dr. DeRose. Stay tuned. One more segment coming up right after this.
Today's broadcast has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
If a natural disaster comes knocking, how prepared is your family? You can't just close the door on earthquakes, floods, or hurricanes and hope they go away. That's why it's important to make a plan now. Ready.gov/plan has the tools and tips you need to prepare your family for an emergency. So if disaster shows up at your doorstep, you'll be ready. Visit ready.gov/plan and make a plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
I'm just texting him back.
I'm just posting a story.
I'm just changing the song.
I'm just...
No. When it comes to distracted driving, just don't. Sending a text takes your eyes off the road for just 5 seconds, but in that time, your car can travel the length of an entire football field. Any distracted driving just isn't worth it.
Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
What is a number story?
My number story started with fear and a lack of support, and it has led me to be there for others.
A number story begins in our childhood with ACEs, adverse childhood experiences.
My number story begins with the separation from my father and the emotional abandonment from my mother, and leads to me being a role model to not only myself, but those around me by becoming the person that wasn't there for me.
ACEs are so common, 2/3 of us have one.
My number story begins with drug abuse and homelessness, and leads to realizing that I can live life by my own standards.
A study found the more ACEs, the more likely we may experience a host of serious health effects, physical and mental, but that doesn't need to be the case. Your ACE number is simply an entry point to your own story. Where it leads is up to you.
My number story begins with years of emotional abuse, and leads to peace, clarity, and security in my self-worth.
Take control of where your number story leads at numberstory.org.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian and Alaskan Native Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back to our final segment of American Indian and Alaska Native Living. Dr. David DeRose with Dr. Barry Bacon. Barry, you've been sharing with us this amazing vision for global health, and I said we want to bring it back home here to First Nation peoples. We'll bring it back to Africa one more time before we finish. But as I was thinking about your story prior to doing the show, I had to admit to my own ignorance. And if any of you tuning in today say, hey, we're about to start a Native medical school or especially Native-focused medical school, I mean, let me know, because it's not on my radar screen. But it just had me thinking, you know, sometimes it seems, you know, I look around and I've had friends who've graduated from these historically black universities. I mean, think of Meharry University or Howard University, you know, especially having a vision to train black physicians, and had the privilege of working with folks who received training there. And I've said to myself, you know, just in thinking about this show, well, would it make sense to have a medical school, you know, somewhere maybe in the heart of Indian country training Native Americans? I don't know if you've ever asked that question. I know you're up there in the Northwest and you have some pretty close ties with some of the First Nation peoples up there, Barry. Any thoughts along those lines?
I think it's a really good point. What we're finding in Africa is that if you train physicians with their own challenges, with their own culture, with their own language, and with the diseases that they are experiencing, they're going to be better suited to give back to their communities. I think that lesson is applicable to Native peoples in North America, to provide medical education that is specifically for Native peoples, inviting them into a medical education process that really addresses the very, very unique and special challenges that they experience with their health. You know very well, David, that the disease processes and the health disparities in among Native peoples are very different than in most of the United States, for example. Mm-hmm. So I think there's an opportunity. I think medical education would be different. I think it would address the issues that are very, very much need to be addressed among Native people. So yes, medical education close to home with Native challenges for Native peoples with the intention that the people that we work for, David, I know that this resonates with you. The people that I work for are not the big organizations. They're not the big hospital systems. The people that I work for are the people who are suffering. It's the mother mm-hmm. that's suffering at home. It's the elderly, frail individual. Those are the people that I work for and that I want to honor with my life. So it's our patients. And that's what medical education needs to come back to. And I think there's an opportunity to do so for specifically for Native peoples.
So Barry, I know we gave out your contact information about this project in Ethiopia, but as we're talking about maybe translating some of this into a North American context, I know you're spread pretty thin, at least I'm imagining. If someone from a tribe says, hey, this sounds like a fascinating topic, I should reach out to this Dr. Bacon. Are you going to say, if someone sends you an email, say, oh, that was just DeRose going down that direction, I don't have time to talk about indigenous needs in North America? Would that be your response?
No, I would have a very different response. I would say, let's talk about it. Let's have a conversation. Let's develop this. And let's do the same kinds of things that we're doing in Africa. Let's do it close to home and see if we can pull this off. It's a big undertaking in North America, but why not? Why not do that? It's the only things that matter that we accomplish are the things that last into eternity, right? It's the things that continue on beyond our own lives. So that, why wouldn't we have a conversation like that? I would welcome someone contacting me about that subject.
Tremendous. So Barry, one more time, your email address.
Sure. It's baconberry@juno.com. So baconberry@juno.com.
Okay, great. So let's bring it back to Africa, because I know you've got a project there that's getting started. And you and I were speaking off air because we've been talking about medical education. And we have a lot of listeners that are health professionals, people that are leading out in maybe tribal health. Maybe they're not Native, but they just listen to the show. Though the majority of my listeners that may not have any medical training at all, and they're saying, boy, that would be great, but I'm not a health professional. You were actually suggesting to me off air, Barry, and make sure I understood this correctly, that if someone really wants to be involved, there's likely some way that they might be able to be involved regardless of what their background is. Did I read too much into that?
No, I think that it would be accurate to say that way. We're looking for people who can teach fixing equipment, for example. We're looking for people that have hands-on experience. We're looking for farmers, because community education, health education starts with agriculture. It starts with fishing. It starts with care of animals. So people that have experience in those areas, or can teach English, or can teach math, sciences, we have to improve the education, the foundational experience of our high school students, so that they're prepared to take the next step in their education. The kind of medical education we want to provide is more than just the clinical. We want to be excellent clinicians, don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. but the public health aspects, the agricultural needs, the nutritional needs, the water access, the education of children, all of those things, as you know, David, are all factors that determine health. And so if we don't address those issues, and if we don't teach medicine in this way, we're going to miss the opportunity to really change outcomes for the whole region. So much of what we have to do has to be outside of the physician realm, just by necessity, because there's so few of us. But why not become educators in our community? Why not teach our physicians to become people who support community health and prevention and health education? We can be leaders in this regard, and that's the kind of physician that's our target.
So Barry, you've noticed this, I'm sure, as I have. It seems like sometimes the people that are the most altruistic or empathetic or whatever terms we want to use, the people that would resonate with a project like this, it seems like they're often running in so many directions already, just because there's so many needs globally, if not just in their own backyard. But you've been sharing just a bit on this show that you're making a significant difference. I know those aren't your words, but I'm reading between the lines as far as things right there in the Northwest impacting needs of health disparities there in the Pacific Northwest, but also, you know, having a broad reach overseas and really catching this vision for this medical institution in Ethiopia. I say that to ask this question. Someone who's listening, they're just saying, hey, I hear what Dr. Bacon's saying. I'd love to be involved with something in Ethiopia, but I mean, how do I do that with all these other responsibilities? You must have some kind of testimony that suggests that if the Creator's moving on your heart to step out, he's going to provide for some of these other things. What do you tell somebody who wants to pick up that phone or send that email, but they're thinking, boy, how could I take on something else?
I think that's a really good point, because so much of the journey that I've taken with my life hasn't made any sense at all from the outside, because I didn't have the time. I mean, I couldn't carve out a place, but because of the calling that I felt, because of the Creator speaking to me, I said, okay. And I've been to places in the world where I had no business going, where Doctors Without Borders wouldn't go, and the American military had pulled out. But because of the calling, I felt confident, but I had a conversation with the Creator. I don't have any business going there unless you show up, unless you come with me. And so this was really an opportunity to experience the heart of the Creator for people and feel his compassion. And that has changed everything. Yeah. That's a life beyond belief.
So that opportunity is not just an opportunity for Dr. Barry Bacon. It's an opportunity for anybody tuning into this show or anybody who learns about your project in any way. I've jotted your email down. Of course, I had it before we did the interview. But if some have been driving, they've been saying, oh, I hope they give us that email address one more time. I've written down baconberry@juno.com. So that's B-A-C-O-N. Barry, B-A-R-R-Y, at Juno, J-U-N-O.com. And if you reach out to Dr. Bacon, I'm assuming there's going to be some times when you are in Ethiopia and someone will send you that email and it maybe won't get to you efficiently, or you're running for a week or two at a time and they think because they didn't hear back in 5 minutes that you are just one persona on air, but when someone tries to contact you, you don't respond. Would that be a mistake to draw that conclusion?
Yes. Unfortunately, I get a lot of junk mail in my email. I'm sure I'm not unique in that regard. So if you don't hear from me, please write again. Don't feel like you're bothering me. I would love to hear from folks. And even if it's just, I'm on board, I want to pray for you, I want to provide, I want to hear your stories of what you're doing there, I'm happy to include you in our writings as well.
Tremendous, tremendous. Our time has just about slipped away from us, Dr. Bacon. Before we close, I mean, any final words of encouragement if someone's kind of on the fence about actually sending that email and connecting with you?
I would love to hear from folks. I would be happy to include you in any way that we can. But more than anything, I would just encourage you to open your life to the Creator and hear his calling to you, because there's a life there. If you haven't experienced it, it is a life of purpose and meaning, and it is beyond belief.
Amen. I would agree. Thank you, Dr. Bacon, for sharing your precious time with us.
You're welcome.
And to each one of you, my listeners, thank you for joining us. Hopefully this interview with Dr. Bacon has made an impact on your own life, and that you won't just say, hey, that was inspiring, but you'll ask the question, what am I going to do differently as a result of this interview? Well, as always, I'm Dr. David DeRose, wishing you the very best of health.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.